This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Peter Bergen has been reporting and writing about Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda since the late 90s, when, as a producer for CNN, he got bin Laden to agree to an interview. Over the past 10 years, Bergen's traveled to Afghanistan, Pakistan, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia to report on bin Laden and his organization. He's also been kind enough to be a regular guest on this program. His most recent book is The Osama Bin Laden I Know, The Oral History of Al-Qaeda's Leader. Now, along with fellow scholar Paul Cruikshank, he has an article in the current issue of The New Republic called The Unraveling, Al-Qaeda's Revolt Against Bin Laden, where he chronicles the growing disillusionment and, in some cases, the outright repudiation of bin Laden and al-Qaeda's leadership by several former supporters and mentors. That doesn't mean that al-Qaeda is no longer a threat, they conclude, but that it is losing the war of ideas. Peter Bergen joins us in a moment. We'll also talk with a former Mujahideen fighter who is among al-Qaeda's critics. Later, as exercisers move indoors to escape the heat, the gym gets weirder. What are the worst gym sins you've ever seen? But first, the jihadist revolt against bin Laden. If you've read the New Republic piece or have questions about the growing criticism of bin Laden and al-Qaeda from former allies, give us a call. Our number is 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org, and you can join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Peter Bergen joins us here in Studio 3A, and always nice to have you on the program.
Afternoon, Neil.
And when you argue that bin Laden is losing the war of ideas, you emphasize he's not losing it to Washington or to the West, but to former allies with credentials as a Mujahideen.
Yes. I mean, a number of the people we spoke to for the piece are people who either fought with bin Laden in Afghanistan, Noman Bin Noman, a Libyan leader of a militant group, Abdullah Anas, who's going to be on the show later, who is a son-in-law of Abdullah Azam, arguably the most important figure in the jihadist movement, Sheikh Salman al-Auda, a very important religious scholar in Saudi Arabia who bin Laden looked to for spiritual advice, who's now very publicly turned against him. So what's interesting about this, Neil, is it's militant scholars, people who fought in Afghanistan, people very hard for al-Qaeda to paint as sort of stooges of the West, who are making this critique on both religious and strategic grounds.
What are the religious grounds to begin with?
Well, it's so basic, as you know. The Quran forbids the killing of civilians, particularly fellow Muslims. This is something bin Laden's never really been able to satisfactorily explain. When he's asked these questions about how do you justify the killing of civilians, say on 9/11, he'll say, well, the people in the World Trade Center weren't at a playground, they were helping finance the American economy, and they're responsible for American foreign policy in that way. Well, that's not an argument from religion, it's a political argument. So bin Laden well knows that on religious grounds this is very hard to justify, and this is what people are pointing out.
And what about on the strategic level then?
On the strategic level, people like Noman Bin Noman, one of the leaders of the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, is saying, look, we're trying to get regime change around the Middle East, replace these dictatorships with, Islamist regimes in a sense, and that by attacking the United States, bin Laden has made that much more complicated. And I think that's true. I mean, the authoritarian regimes in the Middle East are stronger than ever after 9/11. If the intent was to get rid of them, as bin Laden intended to by attacking the United States, that's been a strategic failure.
And as you look into this, though, a lot of these people you talk to, again, yes, some are former mentors, and you mentioned Sheikh Uthman, a very important one. Nevertheless, are these al-Qaeda insiders? Are these people who are important to him who are defecting now?
Well, it's more complicated than that, Neil. I mean, Sheikh Salman al-Awad has never been an al-Qaeda insider, but he has been, by bin Laden's own account to myself and Peter Arnett in 97 when we interviewed him from CNN, the reason that he turned against the United States is that Sheikh Salman al-Awda was one of the principal critics of American forces being put on Saudi territory as a result of Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait, and then he was imprisoned by Saudi authorities. So bin Laden says, the reason that I declared war against the United States, in part, was the imprisonment of this very cleric, Sheikh Salman al-Awda, who's now turned against bin Laden. And Neil, the important thing is he's not condemning terrorism. He's not condemning 9/11. He's condemning bin Laden by name. This is very important because there are plenty of people who said that 9/11 was wrong or terrorism is wrong. But really, turning against bin Laden personally, one of the people that we quote in the piece, Noman Bin Noman, wrote an open letter to al-Qaeda's number two late last year, which got a lot of play in the Middle East. And so when they're critiquing bin Laden, Ayman al-Zawahiri by name, this is very different than just saying, well, well, you know, terrorism was wrong, 9/11 was wrong.
There's another figure you mentioned in the piece known as Dr. Fadl, who is, again, another important intellectual architect of jihadism.
Yeah, and in fact, you could easily paint him as a real al-Qaeda insider because he was the founder of the Jihad group in Egypt, which would later morph into al-Qaeda, and by his own account, early in al-Qaeda's history, the leaders of al-Qaeda would consult Dr. Fadl for all sorts of religious and sort of strategic purposes. So this guy has now written a book from prison condemning al-Qaeda, condemning bin Laden, and also given interviews repeating these charges. And in fact, he got so much under Ayman al-Zawahiri's skin, the number two in al-Qaeda, that Ayman al-Zawahiri took it upon himself to write a 200-page book in reply. So clearly, al-Qaeda's leaders are realizing this is a problem.
And as you say, they're trying to reply to it. Nevertheless, has this affected their recruiting? Has this affected their finances?
Well, that is a hard thing to tell. But I think, you know, I think it is a commonplace to say we're in a war of ideas. And if some of the important architects of the war on the other side of the equation are withdrawing their support from al-Qaeda, I mean, that is very damaging in the long term. This isn't going to happen overnight. One metric that we're seeing is a sharp decline in Muslim civilian support for al-Qaeda, whether it's in Pakistan or Indonesia, which, after all, are two of the largest Muslim countries in the world, where support for suicide bombing is tanking, support for al-Qaeda is, you know, plummeting, support for bin Laden is plummeting. So it's not just at the elite levels, it's also at the kind of man-in-the-street level that this is happening. Which is not to say that al-Qaeda isn't a threat, but they are losing this particular war of ideas.
And some take comfort in the idea that where regular civilians, Muslim civilians, are exposed to al-Qaeda, they tend to reject it and point to Anbar province in Iraq.
No doubt. And I just came back from Iraq 2 days ago, and al-Qaeda in Iraq is not destroyed, but it is largely defeated, precisely for this, you know, Taliban-style regimes that they try to install wherever they held territory.
And yet some people are saying, look, al-Qaeda is failing to rally the masses. And other people say, well, you know, rallying the masses, that isn't what they're trying to do.
Well, that's a very good point. I mean, if Bruce Hoffman, one of the great theorists of terrorism, was here, he would point out correctly that Brigati Rossi and Bader Meinhof in the 70s, you know, had no popular support at all, yet basically, you know, created an immense amount of chaos in Germany and Italy. So it doesn't require a great amount of public support. But as the public support evaporates, that doesn't help them, surely. And so al-Qaeda may have regrouped on the Afghan-Pakistan border. That is certainly a problem for the Britain and potentially for the United States. But in militarily, they're doing quite well right now compared to where they were in 2002. Ideologically, they're beginning to lose the battle.
And you say, in fact, contain ideologically the seeds of their own destruction.
Yes, it's by this doctrine of takfir, which is they decide who's Muslim and who isn't. And what turns out, their decision is that basically anybody who doesn't precisely share their views is actually not a Muslim. And that allows them to say, well, they're apostates, and eventually to kill them, which is basically the chain of reasoning we've seen in Algeria in the 90s and Egypt in the 90s, in Iraq, in Anbar province, as you pointed out, where many of their victims were Sunni Muslims. Al-Qaeda in Iraq killed a lot of Sunni Muslims, people who were smoking, for instance, or, you know, very trivial things that didn't by any standard, which resulted in deaths for people that they thought were doing wrong.
Nevertheless, we've seen a tremendous upsurge in suicide bombings in Pakistan. And as you mentioned, al-Qaeda and its Taliban allies are doing extremely well at the moment, or seem to be, in Afghanistan.
Well, that's absolutely right, Neil. So, you know, in Pakistan, we've seen more suicide attacks in Pakistan last year than in the rest of Pakistani history, something like 60 suicide attacks. So this organization on the Afghan-Pakistan border still has life in it.
There were also those who say al-Qaeda itself, well, it represents part of the threat, but its real concern has to be about these disparate organizations, many of them in Western Europe, who are inspired by, though not controlled, by al-Qaeda.
Well, certainly that is a threat, but I think that's it's a question of how you order the threat. I mean, al-Qaeda is a strategic threat to the United States if it's capable of doing a 9/11. Self-starting homegrown radicals can maybe kill a few people here and there, but they aren't strategic threats to the United States and their allies. I mean, we've seen in the United States a number of plots, none of which were very serious, by self-starting homegrown radicals since 9/11, but it was basically amateur hour. In Europe, you know, the Madrid attack of 2004, which killed 191 commuters, looks pretty much like a self-starting homegrown radicals kind of attack. But that's not 9/11. So if Al Qaeda, it's when these things join, the self-starting homegrown radicals and Al Qaeda Central, it's when they meet, it's when those radicals travel to Pakistan, get the training, that you really begin to have a problem. We saw that on July 7th, 2005 in London. Radicalized in the north of England, travel to Pakistan, get the training, kill 52 commuters on the way to work in London, the biggest terrorist attack in British history. So that's, these aren't either or categories. Both of these are problems.
We're talking with Peter Bergen. He's the author of, or co-author of, The Unraveling, Al-Qaeda's Revolt Against Bin Laden. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. Jeff is on the line. Jeff calling from Cleveland.
Good afternoon. My question concerns the funding for Al-Qaeda at this point. Obviously, we've been told that they're still a threat. Who's given them the money to help train people and send them out into the world and cause all this?
Well, you know, I've been looking at some of the documents that Al-Qaeda in Iraq was seized by the U.S. military. And what's really interesting about that, there's two interesting things. The people who came to conduct suicide operations, the terrorists, who are mostly foreigners in Iraq, they paid for themselves to come. In fact, they brought money with them to contribute. So this was a self-financed operation. On the other hand, running the insurgency in Iraq was quite expensive. And where did that money come from? I think it came from a combination of kidnapping, corruption, oil smuggling, all sorts of things. So if you look at, you know, it depends where the insurgency is. Obviously, in Afghan Pakistan, you know, the big money draw there is the opium trade. Running an insurgent operation is expensive because you have to pay salaries. Running a terrorist organization is very inexpensive because people volunteer. The London attack of July 7th, 2005 was entirely self-financed on credit cards.
Sad.
Jeff, and you know, where do the bills go? That's what I wonder. Anyway, Jeff, thanks very much for the call.
Thanks for having me on, Neil.
All right, Peter, stay with us. If you'd like to join the conversation again, our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. Coming up, we'll speak with a former Mujahideen who's now a critic of Osama bin Laden. I'm Neil Conan. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking today with terrorism expert Peter Bergen, who's the co-author of an article in The New Republic about criticism of Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden from within and how the organization is changing as a result. If you've read The New Republic piece or if you have questions about the growing criticism of bin Laden and Al-Qaeda from former allies, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And you can read what other listeners have to say on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Joining us now on the line from London is Abdullah Anis. He's the Osama bin Laden. He met Osama bin Laden in Pakistan in 1984 and fought against the Soviets in Afghanistan for 9 years in the 1980s. Nice to have you today on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
And can you tell us, was there a moment when Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden did something about, was there a moment when you decided to go public about your criticisms of them?
You know, we have, this is our duty to defend the innocence everywhere. So because we are Muslims, we are Mujahideen, in the past we were Mujahideen in order to defend the rights of people, to defend the rights of the innocents. So any group, anyone could harm or damage the people, we are against him. It could be Osama bin Laden or not. Everyone in the East or in the West, Muslim or non-Muslim. So this is our duty. We are not happy for the killing of the civilians or for damaging the societies or attacking the innocents everywhere. So this is our duty. I'm not doing it because for politics. I'm not an American. I'm not a European, and also I'm not a member of Al-Qaeda. So we have we believe in our principles. So that's why this is our duty.
So you, by that definition of jihad, the struggle in Afghanistan against the Soviets was justified, as would the struggle against the United States in Iraq be justified?
You know, In Afghanistan in 1984, there was a fatwa. We call it in Islam fatwa. It's an order signed by a group, very large group of scholars through the Islamic world, that Afghanistan was occupied by the Soviets, and it's a duty of every single Afghani or every single Muslim in the world to help the Afghans to liberate their land. So this is something legitimated by in Islam. But we have to separate between two things. What we saw in Iraq, it was not at all similar to what was in Afghanistan. First of all, the Afghans Arabs, or the foreigner fighters in Afghanistan, they were under leadership of the Afghans themselves. In another way, the politicians who were playing the role of the liberation in Afghanistan were the Afghans themselves. They were free to negotiate or not to negotiate, to stop, to do ceasefire or not. We were just supporting them. But in Iraq, this it is a big deviation happened in Iraq. Al Qaeda, when they were in, they went to Iraq, they declared themselves an independent group, an independent political party, fighting without the orders of the Iraqi leaders. So that's why, instead of helping the Iraqis, they made it more worse. They started fighting against Shia. They started fighting against UN. They started fighting against the other Sunnis who are not agreeing with their point of views. They started fighting in Amman. So it's completely different. We cannot. I cannot compare jihad in Iraq to the jihad in Afghanistan during the Soviet Union.
And some would say that in Afghanistan now, with the United States there and NATO forces there, in many ways it's no different from the days when the Soviet Union tried to steal Afghanistan's independence.
Yes, it's completely different. This is my personal point of view. I don't know if it's will get the majority in the Islamic world, sharing me this view or not. But at least I should take responsibility. I don't think so. What is happening in Afghanistan from both sides? I cannot say that Taliban are fighting jihad. Also, I don't think so that NATO is in there fighting against terror, because it's everything went in the wrong direction there. The people who are saying fighting jihad against NATO, I think we should ask them. I don't think so. If 11 of September, did not happen, I wouldn't see any soldier there. So I don't think so. The matter of occupation isn't there. And at the same time, I don't think so. Now the international forces are fighting against terror, because the mistakes happening every day, every week, bombing sometime weddings, bombing sometime civilians. So I don't think so. It's the same situation. I cannot compare it with the jihad during the Soviet Union.
And finally, some people would worry that speaking out publicly against Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda might expose you to retaliation, to attacks.
We say what we believe. If anybody attack us for what we believe, we don't mind. I'm in the death list twice. I was in the death list of GIA in Algeria, the armed group, Islamic armed group, and at the end, everyone knows in Algeria that this group was bloody group, was criminals, killing civilians. And also, I'm not spokesman of anyone, east or west. I'm spokesman of my Islam, of what I believe. So I don't mind.
Abdullah Anas, thank you very much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
And Peter Bergen, just a little bit more. Who is this man and why is he so important?
Well, Abdullah is a friend of mine, and he has got extraordinary credibility on these issues because he is the son-in-law of Abdullah Azzam, who is arguably the founder of the modern jihadist movement, basically also bin Laden's most important mentor, who between them they set up the services office, which became the office that brought foreign fighters and also Muslims from around the world to help the Afghan jihad against the Soviets. And as you mentioned in the introduction, Abdullah fought personally for 9 years inside Afghanistan for Ahmad Shah Massoud. So he is the real deal.
Let's get a caller on the line. And this is Matthew. Matthew with us from Sacramento in California.
Hi. I just wanted to ask, given that al-Qaeda is a relatively young organization, do you think it's possible that they're going to follow the same development that groups like the IRA have, where they've become more like political parties and less like militant organizations? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, Matthew.
That's an excellent question. By the way, al-Qaeda is about to celebrate its 20th anniversary in August. A little over a dozen people spent a couple of weekends in late August of 1988 and founded al-Qaeda. That organization within 13 years inflicted more direct damage on the United States than the Soviet Union had done during the Cold War. So this organization has been around for a while. Will it turn into a political organization? I don't think so. You know, the terrorist groups that become political organizations tend to usually have one demand: get the British out of Northern Ireland for the IRA. You know, let's have a Basque home country for ETA and Spain. You know, Al-Qaeda wants global transformation. It wants a Taliban-style theocracy from Indonesia to Morocco. This is not really a negotiable demand.
So they're not likely to morph into something with a political arm as Sinn Féin was for the IRA.
Or, you know, Hezbollah in Lebanon. I just don't see that. I mean, Hezbollah in Lebanon wants to create a sort of Shiite-like state in one country. Bin Laden wants global transformation.
Another thing that Hezbollah or Hamas has also done, they're social activist organizations,
right,
providing services to the people. Al-Qaeda has never been about providing services to the people.
Do the thought experiment of an Al-Qaeda hospital. You know, it's an oxymoron. It's not going to happen.
Let's get Mike on the line. And Mike is calling us from Columbia in South Carolina.
Yes, thank you for taking my phone call.
Go ahead, please.
I wanted to ask if Mr. Bergen could recommend or knew how we could best exploit this potential divide, because Al-Qaeda has used religion as the basis of their argument. And if we can somehow turn religion against them and turn them into criminals or portray them as criminals, I was wondering if that is possible or if that would have any kind of effect. And unfortunately, I'm away from my car right now, so if I could possibly hear the answer on hold.
Oh, sure. No, that's no problem.
There's several. I think the United States, there's a natural tendency to do things because we have so much kind of firepower and different means at our disposal. This one we should just let happen. I mean, there's the kiss of death problem. We don't have credibility on this issue. We don't have the knowledge to really talk about it in any great with any great authority. And it's much more valuable if this criticism is coming from within the Islamic community.
Parmesan or tiny.
That's why you're away from your car. I'm sorry. We're out of the Parmesan, Mike. Thanks very much for the call. we get the best calls on Talk of the Nation. Jen's with us. Jen calling from Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Hi there. How are you today?
I'm well, and we're glad our callers are well fed. But go ahead, Jen.
I'm just curious as to how it has played out as information like this about the internal dissent in al-Qaeda has filtered into the West. Has this been covered a lot in mainstream media in other countries in particular? And do politicians in the Europe and the West, have they found a way to take advantage of that? And I'll take an answer off the air.
Okay, Jen, thank you.
Certainly, these disputes have been widely covered in the Arab world. And now, Larry Wright has a piece in The New Yorker making some of the same points this week. We did our piece. I see a piece in Newsweek this week taking a slice of this. Our story's been reprinted in some British and Canadian newspapers. And I think that, you know, this is getting wide attention, and General Hayden, Mike McConnell, the Director of National Intelligence, testified in February, made a sort of glancing reference to this, and other counterterrorism officials within the U.S. administration have started paying attention to this. So I think it is getting some wide attention.
Yet one hesitates to accept good news on its face. It often precedes a big letdown.
Yeah, I in this case, I'm fairly confident that this has got some legs.
We're talking with Peter Bergen about an article that of which he is the co-author that appears in the current issue of The New Republic. It's called The Unraveling, Al-Qaeda's Revolt Against Bin Laden. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. And this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. The stage where a lot of this is playing out is, in fact, in London, where, well, for example, tell us the story of the Finsbury Avenue Mosque.
Well, you know, London has often been referred to as Londonistan, and, you know, arguably London is the most important place in the Arab world for ideas, because that's where the principal newspapers are published, that's where the principal television stations are have studios, that's where a number of the most important dissidents live. So trends in London really mean a lot. And so the Finsbury Park Mosque was where Abu Hamza, the famous one-eyed, no-handed cleric, ran a sort of rest stop for Al-Qaeda wannabes like Richard Reid, the shoe bomber, Zakiris Massawi, the so-called 20th hijacker. And what has happened there is there was sort of a coup helped by the British Metropolitan Police, installing a more moderate regime. Now, when I say more moderate, it's sort of a Muslim Brotherhood-flavored regime, which means that their views on Palestine may be, you know, quite different from a number of people listening to this show. But
and certainly from the British government.
Well, yeah. Yeah, but I mean, I think the British Metropolitan Police are savvy enough to realize that, you know, let's not sort of pretend that everybody's all in one basket. And if we have they have ideas that we disagree with, somehow they're all our enemies, which I think is, you know, we've seen too much of that. What they're saying is, you know, if people are Muslim fundamentalists and they want to take over this mosque and they're not involved in violence and they've abjured it, fine.
And they have taken over the mosque despite the protests of the supporters of the previous regime who came out in force.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Abu Hamza had a lot of sort of, you know, jihadi wannabes who were part of his congregation. So, but, you know, that has been quite a successful takeover. And Finsbury Park Mosque is one of perhaps two mosques in London that were, you know, the most militant mosques in the capital. And now it's in very different hands.
Well, let's talk with Robert. Robert on the line with us from Tallahassee, Florida.
Yes, good afternoon, gentlemen.
Afternoon.
Peter, I had a question. How much has the strength of the U.S. military or our resolve over the past 7 years to go after Al-Qaeda relentlessly, how much of an effect has that had on their internal decision-making, and has that led to some of their dissent? Thank you.
You know, I mean, a lot of this is happening independently of what we do. I mean, no one in our piece that we talk to is in, you know, all the people we interviewed or talk about have got nothing to do with the U.S. military, good, bad, or indifferent. They don't, you know, this is an internal debate that's taking place within the Muslim community. You know, and, you know, where bin Laden is located is in Pakistan, almost certainly, where we have no U.S. military presence that I'm aware of. If we do, it's, you know, a handful of people. And so, you know, he's certainly not feeling the pressure from that point of view. In Iraq, having just got back from there, clearly the surge was one of about eight different factors that has produced the Al-Qaeda in Iraq taking a number of severe hits. But that includes Sunnis themselves and Anbar turning against this group, a much larger Iraqi army trained by, of course, the U.S. military. The Maliki government making some right moves now in Mosul in the north against Al-Qaeda, and many other factors. But, I mean, I've noticed on the blogs that came out after our article was released that a lot of people wanted to paint it, well, this was because of United States military action in Afghanistan and Iraq, which, frankly, this has got almost nothing to do with what the debate is about. The debate is about is a religious debate. Mostly about whether it's okay to kill Muslim civilians, which is we unfortunately have done too much of that ourselves in Afghanistan, where last year Afghan, American, and NATO forces killed more Afghan civilians than the Taliban did, something we need to obviously change.
Yet, the criticism would be that, nevertheless, people like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed are now in Guantanamo Bay. They're not on the loose in Karachi.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's great. Of course, he wasn't caught by the U.S. military. He was caught by a combination of the CIA and the Pakistani ISI, for what it's worth. So, you know, unfortunately, military actions in Iraq, eventually we've got to the point where we almost defeated al-Qaeda in Iraq, but we introduced al-Qaeda into Iraq. They didn't exist there before our invasion. I mean, al-Qaeda in Iraq officially came into existence October 2004, which is a little over a year after we first invaded. So it's been a long and expensive process, and so many lives and so much money has been spent. But we are doing better there now today.
Peter Bergen, thanks very much. Appreciate it. Peter Bergen, co-author of a story in the latest issue of The New Republic called The Unraveling Al-Qaeda's Revolt Against Bin Laden, and he joined us here in Studio 3A. Coming up, whether it's a pool of sweat on the elliptical machine or foot fungus in the showers, there are a myriad of sins that can be committed in the gym. What have you seen? Plus, your letters on what you want your final resting place to be. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.